Hello and welcome back to the Isle of Wight show with me, Joe Redstone. Today I am talking to Ian Boyd, who you may know from his involvement with ARC Consulting, Art Ecology, the Common Space, the Hullabaloo event, and many other things, including the Pooh Museum, all of which we talk about at various points. But this is a very wide-ranging conversation, and Ian and I also talk about conservation generally, the role of charities in society, the importance of the Isle of Wight globally in terms of the fossils that you can find here, the relationship between your brain and your gut, and also what we can learn by looking at regeneration through a slightly wider lens than perhaps some of us do on occasion. So, as I say, this conversation goes all over the place. I loved it, and I hope you do too. Without further ado, here is Ian Boyd. Okay, hello again, everyone. I'm here today with Ian Boyd. I'm not going to try and give a sort of brief summary of what Ian does because he's involved in a huge amount of things. Hopefully, we'll get stuck into those as we continue. Welcome, Ian. Thank you very much for agreeing to speak to me today. Really appreciate that.
That's okay.
Yeah, if you could start off by telling me your Isle of Wight story. How did you end up down here?
Accidentally, really, and well, entirely. So my background is working for conservation organisations. So I did a long apprenticeship with folks like the RSPB and the County Wildlife Trusts, living and working on nature reserves. That was my life, really, and it was wonderful. But when you start a family, it gets pretty tricky. The pay isn't great. And so I was just really looking for something that paid a little bit more that was still in the same area. And got an interview on the island. This was way, way back. This is 24 years ago, when there was a countryside management service on the island, and I joined that as part of their ranger team. And so I was kind of still doing actively conservation-y kind of stuff, looking after. It was still chainsaws and tractors and things, you know, which is what I loved. And things moved on from there, but it was entirely accidental.
Okay, so you've been here 24 years
yes.
now, you say.
Yes.
Excellent. And if we were to try and sum you up in one word, I think probably ecologist, does that kind of cover it?
It does. I mean, I have to say that really I'm probably more of an old school naturalist.
Right.
And folks, they get confused between naturalist and naturist, which is often a problem. And I just have to go through the whole thing with them, explaining why I'm wearing clothes. But actually, old school natural history is really a lost art, I think. And it's the wonderful thing about that is it includes ecology, of course it does, but it is, in a nutshell, it is a familiarity with the natural world. That's essentially what it is. So if you step out of your door, you are likely, well, first of all, you'll be interested enough to have made it your business to know the names of most of the plants you see and most of the butterflies and most of the birds. So you can walk into a place and kind of think, yep, I can see how this is functioning, and you'll pick up more and more features of interest. But that old style generalism is perhaps a rarer thing. It's perhaps not needed as much, I don't know, but that's what I have come from, and that's what I am, really.
Okay, and so where would you say the distinction lies then between a naturalist and an ecologist? Is there a definite distinction between those two
things? I think it's all part of a spectrum, really.
Right.
Ecology is quite specifically the relationship between organisms and the environment that they inhabit. So it's actually all about relationships. The really interesting thing about ecology is it is just as much about people, if you choose to look at it that way. So what we forget is that there is a human ecosystem, that people are part of the natural biological world. We pretend we aren't in all sorts of technological ways, but we are, and we function as part of our environment in the same way. So that is one part of natural history. Natural history has perhaps a softer and more general feel, which is, as I said, just a familiarity with the things around you and what they are. It's often the naming of things. It's actually taxonomy. So being able to distinguish this living thing from this living thing. And that, we do a lot of schoolwork, and that can just be an extraordinary effect. If you explain to a group of kids and adults, this box full of bugs that you've just collected are not all insects. In fact, there's almost no insects in there because it's full of woodlice and centipedes and spiders, none of which are insects. And suddenly you're into this realm of saying we're discriminating the natural world and your horizons are broadening. So that isn't an insect. No, it's not an insect. And that's not an insect either. That's another thing. It's a different kind of thing. Natural history has a lot of that in it.
Yeah, okay. So you touched on the schools there. That's definitely something that I'd like to talk about. So give us a brief introduction to the sort of things that you might do with the local schools.
It's most often a visit to their school and an exploration of the school grounds with lots of excited young people finding bugs. I remember doing that at my school. We have a wonderful device, which is a big help. We have a bug hoover, which is a leaf vacuum, a garden leaf vacuum with a butterfly net shoved up the end. We use it professionally too. It's a really good way of sampling the environment very quickly, relatively painlessly. Most things, survive intact and we can put them back afterwards. The great thing is it's noisy, it's a bit smelly, it's quite exciting. All the kids can use it quite safely. You are guaranteed to find something. And that is perhaps the most important thing. By bringing this device to a school, even in the least promising environment, so essentially concrete, perhaps one flower bed, a bit of playing field, even if there isn't a bit of playing field, we will find something. And that alone is a great starting point. Life is everywhere. It is absolutely everywhere. And you just need to look a little bit closer and you'll find it. And you have a relationship with this living world, even here in this developed space. And then we start to unpick it and we decide what things are and where they live and what can we do to help them and what can you do to help them. And on we go from that point.
And is that done through ARC? And so ARC is the company that you run? Forgive me if I'm a little bit fuzzy on some of the details here.
That's okay.
It's probably better if I get you to explain it. Tell us a little bit about ARC.
It is a fuzzy domain, and we quite often forget who we are at any given moment. And in some ways, it's because we have so many, and when I say we, I mean me and my amazing colleagues and friends, and it's a collective in a sense, really, but we have packaged up the things we're interested in doing on the island into these various companies. And so ARC, as you rightly say, ARC has been going the longest. That is a consulting ecology firm. So we offer professional, technical, ecological advice to anyone who needs it. Often it's the planning industry. That's mainly where that comes from. So that is where we earn most of our income from that route. We actually choose to spend quite a lot of it on doing things like the school's work and doing lots of other bits and pieces. That has led to a setting up a non-profit company called The Common Space, which is very specific. This is a much longer story. But to keep it brief, that is all about the bay. So Sandown Bay, Sandown, Shanklin, Culver and Luckham, extraordinary place, just the most amazing place. I live and work here, but it is phenomenal as a natural resource, much undervalued, far too pessimistic about the place. So we spend a lot of our time and our money and our effort here trying to extract that value and put it in front of people in an exciting, appealing way. Then we also have a wonderful thing called Art Ecology, and Art Ecology stems from ARC. We quite often through ARC are talking about planting schemes and about green space and about more familiar conventional spaces you might expect to have wildlife in them. Art Ecology is the revelation that the built environment, your house, your school, your factory, this road, that car park, all have ecological value. It may be small, but it has ecological value. What can we do to make that better? How can we extract maximum ecological value from the built world? Mainly marine for us at the moment, but lots of stuff going on there.
Okay, so let's get practical about this then. So with the sort of things that you do with Art Ecology, for those of us who maybe live in and around the Bay Area or further afield, what are some basic things that we can do at home that might start making a difference?
Okay, there's a whole load of things you can do in your garden and in and around your house. That can create greater ecological density. There's just more life going on in your territory. And a lot of this is about territory, because I'll come back to that in a sec, it's quite important. So for a start, let's start from the green space before we go to the grey space. The things you have in your garden, What we are very interested in is just edibility. So when we think about the wildlife that comes to your garden, let's say butterflies, really good example. Everyone loves butterflies. No one really loves caterpillars, but you're not going to get any butterflies without caterpillars. Butterflies live for a very short period of time. They live on sugar. There's no protein. They just, all of the protein, everything that goes into making a butterfly came from being a caterpillar. So caterpillars live for a lot longer. They may live for a whole year. They may overwinter as a caterpillar. Butterflies live for just a few weeks. So we should be much more interested in caterpillars than we are in butterflies. Flowers, fantastic. Anything that's got nectar in it will attract butterflies. They're not particularly fussy, unlike some other insects. But you have got to have the right suite of foliage to support caterpillars. So just have a think about what's in your garden and how edible it is and what things you may want to attract. Sure enough, if you have adult butterflies coming to your garden for the flowers, they will egg lay on the right plants if you supply them. So have a think about food plants and what's called life cycle gardening. Can you provide in your garden food for the juvenile stuff and for the adult, and provide a nook or a cranny for them to spend the winter in, because they'll spend the winter as an adult, or as a larvae, or as a pupa, maybe underground. And we need to think about that. If you can get that working, wildlife won't just visit your garden, it'll live in your garden year-round. And that's the key thing. So there's one whole area of stuff.
Okay. And can we, again, digging into a few details on that, can you give us a heads up on a few specific plants that perhaps have lots of benefits for that kind of thing?
So everyone's very familiar with nettles, but don't think you have to have nettles. There are lots of nettles in the world. Don't panic about nettles. And people are turned off from wildlife, creative wildlife gardening, by thinking, well, I've just got to have nettles. I hate nettles, but I've got to have them if I'm going to have wildlife. Nettles are good. I'm not saying don't have them, but don't feel you have to. You want to have plenty of pollen nectar, so unfussy flowers. Overbred flowers that are very complicated are just too difficult to get into for many pollinating insects, or may have almost no nectar reserves in them at all. So go for simple, basic versions of garden plants. Garden plants are good. Garden plants are fine. There are lots of nice options in the way of shrubbery, so things like Guelderose. Guelderose is a beautiful, it's a viburnum, there's lots of viburnums you can get. Viburnums are generally very good. It's a beautiful thing. Lots of things live on the foliage, lots of things live on the flowers, and it also has berries, so it's got those three things, those three resources. Grasses are very good. So ornamental grasses are maybe not so popular in landscaping and in gardening as they could be, but they are tremendously valuable. They provide an overwintering habitat. Lots of moth species feed on their larvae feed on grasses. I mean, it's a long list. There's all sorts of stuff. There's lots of information out there. RHS is very good. There's lots of good websites. But just home in on picking stuff that's going to feed the larval forms as well as the adults. That's the key.
And you mentioned a couple of minutes back, you said territory, and then you kind of went, oh, I want to come back
okay,
to that.
Yeah.
Let's go back to that now. What did you mean?
So this is a whole area of really fascinating work, and it's how wildlife occupies space. So we can often trick ourselves into thinking that everywhere is equally important for wildlife. And there's nothing wrong with taking that view, but that's just not how it works. Wildlife is concentrated in patches of high value, and it kind of moves through the rest of the space just to get from one place to another. So it's much more interesting to concentrate your efforts in small patches and allow wildlife to move from your small patch to your neighbour's small patch than feeling that you have to give over all of your garden to wildlife or all of your house to wildlife or fretting over every bit of it. So for example, let's just take, coming back to the art ecology idea of the built environment, a single big flower pot. So let's just say you don't have a big garden, but you can have a flower pot. If you, let's say, have two or three flower pots, and in each of these you plant a different suite of food plants, slightly alter the mix in each. Perhaps in a fourth, you fill it just with sand and soil, nothing else at all. Come back to that in a sec. And the third one, you plug the holes at the bottom and you fill it with water. And if you put those together, you have created an ecosystem immediately. You may want to put a bit of deadwood decoratively nearby so it still looks pretty, it's not a mess. You may want a bit of a rockery around it. Anyway, there's things you can do to create a small ecosystem that has a wetland environment, a bare ground environment, unbelievably important. Lots of things burrow into bare ground. both to breed and as an overwintering resource. It's a fairly safe, you know, 20 centimetres down in a big pot. It's a good place to be over winter with hard frosts. So, and then you've got plants for caterpillars to feed on, and you've got flowers for adult insects and other things to live on. So if you build this little pod, it may be a metre square, 2 metres square. You don't need much space for this. And let's say your neighbour does one, or you do one at the other end of your garden. That's enough, because these mobile organisms will travel maybe 20 metres, 30 metres, 40 metres. They may travel 100, 150 metres if they're bees looking for the next good flower patch. But they don't travel very far. If we can populate the urban environment with these patches of high-value habitat, beautiful, decorative, pleasing to the eye, and we punctuate space with them at meaningful distances, the in-between stuff becomes less of a hassle. We don't need to worry all that much. Of course, we mustn't fill it with pesticides, and all of those things still matter. All I mean is you don't have to do everything everywhere. You just concentrate your efforts in patches, and that can just be a flower pot.
That's... yeah, okay, a few flower pots, that's all we need to get started with. That's fantastic. So it's very obvious from sitting here and listening to you, kind of, number one, how knowledgeable you are, and secondly, how kind of passionate you are about this stuff. Where did that come from? Where has it always been there ever since you know as a kid, were you, you know, scrabbling around in the dirt picking up bugs and things?
Yes.
Or did it come a bit later?
No, that's exactly how it was. The only thing that saved me from being beaten up every day at school was that I was really good at football, but I had a flower press. I still have a flower press, and that was what I did. And so I knew all the butterflies, I knew all the plants. So that's a risky thing when you're.
And was there a specific influence that brought that?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was certainly, I think, my dad, who was, still is, a kind of frustrated naturalist, really. And it's rather wonderful, actually, because his life was accountancy, which is kind of it's just so much a polar opposite, really. So anyway, when I was young, we would go fossil hunting. I grew up in Birmingham, right in the middle of Birmingham, and not very far away is Wenlock Wren's Nest, very, very famous fossil hunting place, absolutely wonderful. And so my introduction to ecology, in a sense, really was extinct stuff, really. And that's a really important, coming back to the Bay, one of the things we say is the Bay has 100 million years of wildlife, because it does. You can go out on the beach, you can find a thing that is 100 million years old, but it is still a piece of wildlife. It's still an evidence of the natural world and how it has influenced this place and how we might want to respond to it. So it was fossils, and then it was garden birds, and then it was the whole lot, and it's been like that ever since.
Excellent. And then outside of your dad, any other big influences along the way?
I've met so many people. It's impossible to list them all. I worked for the RSPB, who I think are an extraordinary organisation. I know folks have trouble with how big they are and how political they are, but they are just a magnificent organisation. And the people I met, not only the wardens running these reserves, amazing, skillful, dedicated people, but the volunteers coming to work, as I was initially, just amazing people determined to make a difference. And I think, and the same with the County Wildlife Trust organisations that I went to work for, and just to see what could be achieved, I think has stayed with me. And that's still my sort of driving passion, really, is that you can do a lot with relatively little. Most small conservation organisations are very poor. We can trick ourselves into thinking there's nothing I can do until I get the big lottery grant, the Heritage Lottery grant. I'll have to wait 5 years and do nothing. Well, that's just mad, and nothing will happen. There are so many small interventions that you can do, as we've just talked about. And if we do them consistently and we enthuse people to take part, then stuff happens and things change. And that's been my influence, really, from all these wonderful places I've been privileged to work on.
Okay, there's two things I'd really like to pick up on those. We'll come to the slightly more positive side of it in a moment. But one of the things that really fascinates me, and you touched on this, is the sort of political side of organisations like RSPB, and then spreading that a little bit wider, you know, sort of Oxfam and those kind of things. Fundamentally, these organisations are there to do good things. Do you think there's something we could change that might change the public's perception of that? Is there maybe a slightly different way of approaching it now? How do you feel about, you know, the big charities and how they're put together and how they organise themselves?
It's a really tricky one, because I know folks get very exercised about the salaries that top executives get paid in big charities, and I can completely understand that. On the other hand, they run absolutely gigantic organisations, and it's actually wrong to devalue that. And I have exactly the same trouble. I am at the left end of the political spectrum. I have a very big problem with devaluing that kind of civic public work, and I regard that as why have we ended up treating teachers, doctors and nurses as the enemy? I mean, it's just the most extraordinary and perverse place we've ended up. How can we possibly think it's okay to pay teachers almost nothing and to justify it on the grounds that in actual fact it's a vocation? You know, well, that's the same as saying, why don't you just do it for free? And I just get extremely cross about that. So I have a similar point of view when it comes to charities. However, that is not to say that there are some pretty horrifying abuses of that position of power, particularly if you're working in organisations that are dealing with vulnerable communities and vulnerable people. Then that complex of authority, influence and money can become quite toxic. So anyway, what is the remedy to that? I think it is absolutely coming back to grassroots public engagement. We have forgotten about being a civic society completely. Goes back to there is no such thing as society, which is a disastrous thing to have said, let alone implemented. But anyway, we need to remind ourselves there is. And there are things we can do individually and together. In my case, for the natural world. Why would you want to do that? It's because wildlife has a value in and of itself, but we are part of that same shared ecosystem. Our own health, physical and mental well-being, both individually and as a community, is enhanced by being in contact with a healthy environment. And that can be demonstrated by the ecology, the networks, the biodiversity. Our contact with nature, our experience and encounter with wildlife is a part of that. And there are things we can all do to make that work better.
Yeah, I agree. And we touched on this just now with, you know, the flower pots that we can do in our gardens and things as well. But something that it seems quite common to me as I'm wandering about, I feel like I quite regularly meet people who want to help, they want to do something, but they're not quite sure how to go about it. What advice would you have for people like that? Because I think sometimes if you've, you know, sort of volunteerism can sometimes be a word that, you know, sends a shiver down people's spine and is not necessarily something that they feel entirely comfortable with. For people in that sort of situation, what advice might you have for them?
Gosh, right. There is almost too much information available. So anyone who's got access to the internet, you can find what you want. But there's just too much of it. So where do you start? This is going to sound quite an odd point, but quite a healthy place to start is just to distinguish between welfare and conservation. There is a difference between the welfare of an animal and the conservation of its population, of its species in the locality. And if you conflate those, you can make yourself very deeply concerned over the wrong thing. And this is going to sound a bit harsh, but so the plight of an individual baby bird is potentially a tragedy for that individual baby bird. In concentrating all our efforts on all our attention on that issue, we might forget the fact that the population of this, let's say it's a blackbird, which is in no great danger, but there are things we could be doing positively to support the next generation of blackbirds. The feeding of adults in the winter so they make it through the winter, the provision of likely nest sites so that we have plenty of nestlings coming through, is an altogether different matter. And so by exhausting our emotions on the welfare of individual animals, vital though it is, we sometimes leave ourselves unable to look at the conservation of a local population of that species. And that it sounds a little bit esoteric, but it isn't. And I think it can be reassuring sometimes to folks to think, well, I couldn't save that baby blackbird. You know, we won't start talking about cats because I make lots of people very cross, but I don't like them. Anyway, what can I do to make sure that I can get blackbirds to nest in my garden next year? What can I do to make sure that the blackbirds that did fledge are going to make it through the winter? And there's all sorts of things we've already talked about. They need food. Well, where's that food going to come from? It's largely invertebrates in the summer. They're opportunistic feeders. They're woodland birds, but they've made it into the urban realm because they're amazingly resilient and adaptable. Not all birds can do that. And that's also very interesting. Why is that the case? But there are things we can do for the population of blackbirds that we couldn't do for that individual baby bird. And so there's an issue there that sometimes I think folks get very worked up about, that they can perhaps just take a step back and say, well, what can I do? I can do this thing. I can do this thing.
And so, again, digging into some specifics now, you guys do a lot of different things, you know, hullabaloo as you guys, and then I've got written down here things like, you know, Shaping the Bay and Discovery Bay and yes. all these kind of things as well. Yeah. What about if someone wanted to get involved, you know, on a very practical level with those kind of things?
We are involved in a lot of things, and Hullabaloo actually is run by Shade Makers, just an amazing carnival company. But we got very heavily involved through all of our various outlets, really, as Arc Art Ecology and as the Common Space, because that was a wonderful celebration of the Bay. It was absolutely 13,000 people, just mind-boggling. Big science component to that, which worked really, really well, and a celebration of the place. So people can just get in touch. I am very happy for folks just to give me a ring or send me an email. If there are things that we are doing that are of interest to them, then absolutely, you know, there'll be an opportunity to come and get involved. We Discovery Bay, thank you for mentioning that. That's essentially our attempt, with lots of others, to talk about the Bay as a place where natural sciences are freely available, so that you can experience wildlife, have an encounter with wildlife, ancient and modern, in all sorts of places, in all sorts of ways, that is not paywalled, it's freely accessible. How do you find it? Where do you go? So Discovery Bay runs through a calendar that starts with British Science Week in March and ends up in National Biology Week in October, and has Hullabaloo and the walking festival events that we run down here in the middle, and then there's Marine Week. So we kind of have a scaffold of big events, all of which have this natural sciences feel to them. So there's lots of scope to get involved in that, or just to come along to them and see how they run, and that might give you some ideas. But without running through all the possible opportunities, because I don't know what they may be for the next month or the next year or even tomorrow, to be honest, the best thing is just to get in touch with us or have a look on our websites on the Facebook.
Yeah, I'll put links to all your kind of email and stuff like that. I'll stick all that in the show notes, okay. So that'll be there for people who are interested. And we've touched on this a couple of times. You mentioned, you know, the Bay has a kind of 100 million years worth of history. So if we're wandering along the beach, along in the Bay Area, what sort of things might we find in there?
So it's a very famous place for fossils. It's worth just taking a step back and talking about the Isle of Wight in terms of its paleontology. So the Isle of Wight is globally important for its paleontology and specifically for its dinosaurs. So it's impossible to overstate how extraordinary the island is in that way. And again, it's something we don't really talk about. Perhaps we do. Maybe it's a bit superficial. It is superficial. Just over there, in fact, you can't quite see it, but just behind Brown's Cafe, next to where we are sitting, is Dinosaur Isle. We have a fully functioning dinosaur museum, by which I mean an academic seat of learning and study in the world of paleontology. So there are proper scientists doing proper science in there. Okay, it's quite a small place, and there are things that could be done to improve it as an attraction, and lots of people are working on that now, not least Martin and the team in Dinosaur Isle. But at its heart is an accredited museum, a seat of absolute specialist research expertise, and we've got it here on the island, and we've got it here in the Bay. I mean, it's just unbelievable, and we do not talk about it enough, and we don't make use of it enough. So let's say you were walking along the beach, you picked up a curious looking stone. You can walk into Dinosaur Isle and Trevor or Alex or Martin will tell you what it is. And you can take it home. I mean, that's just amazing. It might be something phenomenal. It might be an ammonite, or it might be a piece of iguanodon bone. It might be a pterosaur tooth, you know, these extraordinary flying reptiles. And you can pick it up on the beach at Yavaland. So it's just amazing. One of the other lovely things, just to complete that timeline, is that you might walk along the beach and pick up a bit of ammonite, if you're lucky. And you might, in the next step, pick up a cuttlefish bone. They're essentially the same organism. They are cephalopods, this amazing group. So we love cephalopods, squids and octopuses and all. They're just amazingly clever snails, really. Ammonites did not make it through the last big extinction. Such a shame. Nautilus did, and there were nautiloids about at that time as well, but ammonites didn't make it. But you can pick up this thing, and it's 100 million years old, 90 million years old, and next to it is kind of the same organism, essentially. And to have them both in your hand and to think about that is quite a profound thing. And there's not many places you can do that, really. Certainly there aren't as many places, there aren't many places where you can do that and have this amazing hinterland of woodland and wetland and river valley. And the whole of the bay, is a marine protected area, you know, full of extraordinary things. At low tide, you can walk out and find stuff out on Horse Ledge, up on the Culver Cliff, on the rock pools there. I mean, it's just amazing. It's essentially one gigantic nature reserve, and it's there for free whenever you like it.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. And so possibly from the sublime to the ridiculous here, I'm going to take a little bit of a left turn now. Tell us a little bit about the Poo Museum.
Okay, right. No, I'm glad you said that. That's so the National Poo Museum, which I'm a very proud director, is the brainchild of Daniel Roberts, who is a national treasure, inventor extraordinaire, just a remarkable man, really, and part of a team of artists, themers and makers, Dave Badman, Nigel George, all of whom we are very lucky to have on the island, actually. And we're extremely lucky to have part of our world here in the bay. So the National Poo Museum, just take a look online. Just type the words in and you'll find it. And you'll just be amazed at the reach it's had. So mainly through Twitter. It has this global presence. It's absolutely extraordinary. What is it, though? It is a celebration of poo. That's exactly what it is. Why? Well, because it's kind of fun and it's a bit yuck, and so there's a lot of appeal there, especially for younger folks. It has an exhibition. So these are samples, real ones, things we have found. Bear in mind that we're ecologists and we're out and about. We're identifying the presence of animals in a place by finding a dung pit or a piece of hedgehog poo or whatever it might be. We won't see the hedgehog. So we have plenty of access to the materials, and there are other more curious things in the exhibit too. I won't spoil the fun of going to have a look at it. And these are beautifully presented in big resin globes, so quite safe to handle, entirely safe to handle, but quite beautiful in a way too, the way that it's presented and lit. Anyway, hard to imagine, but you've got to go and see it. There is a whole world of ecological significance about poo. So how is it recycled, the resource it provides, the amazing world of, for example, dung beetles and their lives. And so there's a whole thing about ecosystems and recycling of nutrients. So there's a lot of educational material, a lot of really important fundamental ecological understanding to be extracted from that part of the Poo Museum. However, there is also the fascinating world of human health and the microbiome. So, and this is a really fascinating area. It is very current. So the Poo Museum is working with various institutions and universities, Liverpool University, one of them, in thinking about how does what you eat affect the ecosystem of small organisms, bacteria, that are living inside you. They're not you. They're inhabiting you, so you are their host, and that can sometimes go terribly wrong, and it can sometimes be incredibly good. But that is an ecosystem. The evidence is in what comes out the other end, and there's all sorts of ways of identifying that. That's an entire chart, believe it or not, like a color code. So there's a lot of fun but yuck stuff in that. But fundamentally, what the Poo Museum is teaching us as people who are part of it is that there is an ecosystem inside us. that affects not only our physical health, but also our outlook, our mental well-being, and how that works in the same way that we're working on the one hand with impoverished ecosystems outside. So ecological collapse in some way or another, or a problem in the way that a place is managed and a reduction in the wildlife that is there. It's exactly the same inside. If you have an impoverished, weakened, depleted ecosystem inside you, you are not functioning fully. You may have problems both digestively, but also in terms of your psychological health, the way, and it will affect your perception of the world and how, whether you're optimistic or pessimistic and so on and so on. So how can we manage an internal ecosystem in the same way that we might manage an external one? In the same way we might manage a habitat outside, managing a habitat inside.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, and there's a good chance that I'm not, because science is not my strongest area, what we're essentially talking about here is, I think, understanding how essentially what we eat and drink affects our entire body and the things that are in our body. And you're saying that I think most of us would accept the understanding, you know, that if you eat more fruit and veg, you're probably going to not put weight on and things like that. But there's possibly a psychological element to this as well.
Absolutely. And there's more and more evidence that this is the case. And this, I think, that this combination of interest that we have around ecosystems, the relationships between species, including humans, and the places they inhabit, is reflected in all of the work that we do. And the Poo Museum and ARC and Art Ecology and the Common Space come together really in this peculiar triad. And it's extremely interesting. I keep saying that, but it is. I mean, I just find it endlessly fascinating. And that is that there is a connection between the external ecosystem, the thing that you are walking through, that you are touching, that you are looking at, the way that it functions, the likelihood of encountering wildlife. There is a relationship between that, your mental landscape, so the content that you have in your mind in terms of your appreciation of that place, so the feedback from the external environment into your mind through your senses, the effect that has on you as a person, in terms of memories, in terms of appreciation, in terms of interest, in terms of provocation. And the third part, your gut microbiome. So the ecology that is trapped inside you will then be feeding back into your perception. So your perception of the external ecology may be affected by the health of your internal ecology. So if we can actually make an internal health program for a good, fully functioning gut microbiome, and we can manage the external habitat so that they are full of wildlife, then this circle is complete. And in the middle is the way that you appreciate all of these things, which is through your own mental ecosystem. So there are three ecosystems here: the outside one, the one in your head, and the one inside your body, and they are all intimately connected.
This, I might be making the wrong leap here, but this reminds me of, and I'm not going to remember the guy's name, never mind, but I was reading a few weeks back about a growing connection in terms of our kind of instincts and intelligence between the brain in our head, and then, I mean, I'm going to call it a gut brain for the time being, because I don't remember any of the technical stuff. Is that something that you've come across? Anything?
Oh, definitely.
Are you familiar with that? And we're in the same sort of territory.
Oh, exactly the same territory. And it can start to sound a bit new age and turn people off, but it's much more practical and real than that. This is actual human biology in action. And the exactly as you say, the relationship between your gut brain, and that's exactly how to describe it, the way it functions, your own brain, and the way that you perceive the world and yourself in the world and the external environment that you inhabit are all connected. And that isn't just something to dwell upon, it's something to take action in. So by helping folks to live a healthier life, and that can be both in terms of diet and in terms of the quality of the environment they inhabit, it has a feedback, which means we are much more likely as people and as a community to invest our time and interest in maintaining both ourselves and that external environment. One of the huge problems we've got is that we are building places that are just rubbish habitats for humans. They're awful. So we insist on building communities, new residential developments, stuff that I am involved in quite a lot, that have no real regard for the community that will be inhabiting it. And so the quality, not just of the individual houses, but more importantly, of the shared environment, the public and shared places, the quality of that space, which everyone has a stake in, is often absolutely diabolical. And it can be worse than rubbish. It can be toxic. So if you have a residential development that actually makes people iller, individually and collectively, then that's a disaster. But we do it all the time. And the solutions are some of the things we've talked about. Very simple, small measures just to make it a more interesting, pleasing place to live in. And a place you are more likely to feel invested in. It's not hard, but we just don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, yeah, fascinating. That's fascinating stuff. And again, just, I mean, you touched on this just now, but when I first started reading about this stuff, I had that same reaction of kind of going, oh my word, this sounds like, you know, it's a bit bonkers. But as I looked into it, it's, you know, this is serious scientific research that is being tested and hypothesized and tested again. And it seems like they weren't necessarily saying this is how it is, yeah. But it definitely seems to be pointing in that direction.
I think that's absolutely right. And if there's one message in all of that, that runs through all of this, it is a closer and more meaningful by which I actually mean a more playful relationship between people and the places they live. We are over-sanitized. People are just go, why are there so many wet wipes in the world? It's because we keep bloody well cleaning ourselves with them all the time. And why are we doing this? It's just an absolute madness. People, kids can't pick things up anymore. Or you know, I still do it. If I drop food on the floor, I'll eat it. That's fine. I don't... As far as I'm concerned, I am contributing to my gut microbiome in a very healthy and successful way. I'm not entirely sure that that's always the case, but overall, I think it works. But there are people out there, and I'll give you some examples, who are working so hard to help adults and children to re-find a simple, meaningful, playful connection with the environment they inhabit. The Wildlife Trust on the islands, Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust, absolutely amazing organisation. And there's a team led by Kathy Grogan who run forest schools, they do beach schools, they do woodland therapy. And all of these are playful experiences for kids and for their parents and for teachers and for their classes in how to just re-establish some physical contact and interest in even very local places. And a lot of that philosophy can feed through into place making, into regeneration work. So much of that, this is a big leap, sorry, very big leap, that one, but this is actually the same story. So we look at places that we feel need regeneration. Let's talk about the Bay, for example. And there will be folks who are not malign, it's just the way they see things, who see nothing but dereliction and devastation. And the only answer is to import something new and shiny. So let's have a new 5-star hotel because there's nothing here. Let's have a new toy. Let's invite someone in and build a thing. And that thing will save us. This new thing we'll all gravitate towards and we'll just be astonished. And it will breathe life into a place that has no life. First of all, it has plenty of life. Secondly, it's a disastrous philosophy because it sucks the life out of a place. And this comes down to the fundamental question, which is really, really important to me, this question. When we are doing things and making things, are they adding content to a place or are they extracting content from a place, which is an odd way of phrasing it? Are they giving more than they are taking? So if we forget that a place has content, has a history of people doing things, the products of human imagination in a place, the products of human enterprise, bravery, enterprise, engineering, all of these things have happened in a place. What are their stories? How can we use them? How can we apply them to our lives now? They have environmental content. They have plants and animals and things are living there. What are they? Are they things that we could use? Are there things that could be redeployed or exposed to the world in a new and interesting way? Everywhere has social, cultural, and environmental content. Those are the resources. They're called the foundation capital that we should be using to drive regeneration. You can be fanciful about that and nothing ever happens, but you can choose to look at local content and use it to drive endogenous growth, new business development, new educational opportunities, or you can ignore it all and build a thing on top of it that has none of that content at all and put a paywall around it. And I think that's entirely wrong. It may be part of a bigger picture, but unless you establish the character, distinctive nature of a place and you celebrate it such that everyone who visits it experiences this sense of being in a place, I am in the bay, I am in Sandown Bay, it feels like this because it is Sandown Bay, then you will lose it, because every piece of opportunistic inward investment will simply leech away another little bit of that content, a little bit of that identity.
So that's a fascinating idea. I've never heard it expressed like that. So how do we find the balance between giving and extracting content then? Because if I'm understanding you correctly, this is kind of an obvious statement to say, but if all any of us ever do is extract, eventually we run out. But the flip side of that is, does it work if all we ever do is give, or is there a balance somewhere in between that we need to find?
There absolutely is. The key to it is knowing what that resource is in the first place. So if we don't know the story of a place, I don't mean that you have to have a lecture about its history or its bug life, but if we don't have access to the file that says Sandown, this is how Sandown started. These are some of the big things that happened in Sandown. This is kind of how Sandown's ecosystem functions. This is the names of, these are the names of places in the bay. We forget that places are named. We've just done a really interesting piece of work in Newport. And one of the things that came through was that folks didn't know why Newport was. Where does Newport start and finish? Everyone had a different perception. Actually, Newport is made up of all sorts of individually named real places. Honey Hill, Honey Cross, Gunville. And so on, Pan, Staplers. They're actual real places. And when you start to look at that, then it becomes a navigable place because you are moving from one distinct district with its own story to another one. They're connected, but they are not the same. They are not just Newport. And that's part of this process of unpicking a place to the extent that it has a finer grain of detail that is available to us. And we can then choose to, exactly as you say, to use that, to apply it. It might be, as we found here, that actually that content is beginning to bring in higher education providers. The island has no university. I don't think it can sustain a university. Maybe it can. It doesn't need to. Because if we can actually use the content of a place like the Bay to have 10 visiting universities, each of which has an outreach campus here, you've got 10 universities on the island. And so the opportunities for young people, especially here in the Bay with the new through school, all the changes that are happening here, to be exposed to those visiting classes and lecturers, unbelievable. But that comes from an understanding of what that content is. And we package it up and we say, look, universities, there's an amazing opportunity to come here and do climate science research, natural science research, marine biology, social sciences. Come here and start working here. We learn more. There are job opportunities. There's research funding. There are education. That's just one example of a chain you can build starting with content. And you can do it just the same in the way that you treat new development. So when new development happens, what if it was attracted by that content? Well, we'll never know if we don't talk about it. It might not be the case, but at the very least, we should have a clear enough understanding that when development happens, its contribution is plugged straight into that content. So there will be a developer contribution, fine. It should go on the Sandown Biodiversity Project, the Sandown Public Landscaping Project, the Sandown Historical Project, the Sandown Educational Project, whatever it is, to put more content back in the pot. But if you don't know what that is, then you can't make a start.
Thank you for that. That's, yeah, definitely, definitely food for thought. So we've touched on education there. In your field, what's the area that you find the most frustrating? This might be either in terms of bad information that's given out or perhaps some bad advice that you hear given a lot. What's an area that you wish you could kind of get a message out to people and say, no, it doesn't have to be like that, or that's wrong, or, you know, that kind of thing?
Oh, it's a really interesting question. I think coming right back to the beginning about what it is to be a naturalist, I am frustrated perhaps most of all by our general lack of awareness of the diversity of life that is constantly around us. And okay, that can sound a bit demanding, even a bit snobby. So, well, why don't you know the name of that flower? Why don't? That isn't really what I mean. I don't mean you have to know that it is called this or it is called that. What I mean is that we can look at the natural world around us at a finer grain. And I absolutely believe that, and I think the evidence is there from the work that we do ourselves. You know, we're a small organization working on a small canvas, but the work that we do, the effect it has upon children and adult people of all ages, let's just say that, when they begin to realize that, as I said at the beginning, this box of bugs are not all the same thing. And now that's a small example, but it travels across the way that we look out across the world. I think a finer grain, closer resolution on the world that we inhabit is actually the most frustrating thing. We are trapped perhaps with a more abstract view of places. That's why it's easy to say, oh, sand dune, oh, that's rubbish, isn't it? Almost as a kind of mantra without having any idea what you're saying, when actually at a just slightly closer level of resolution, of course it isn't. What a ludicrous thing to say. It's full of amazing things. We may not be deploying them or connecting them properly, but if we don't look at that level of resolution. So I think it's a closer interest in the places closest to us, rediscovering over-familiar places and finding the delight and fascination that are in them, and then putting that to work. We just don't do that anywhere near enough. We're far too keen to look over that hedge into the next big shiny place and say, well, I have two of those, three of those, and bring them in, regardless of whether they fit or they suit. Let's just look closely, cleverly, and be creative and imaginative about what we already have and start there.
Are you optimistic about the future, about the next, you know, 5, 10, 20, 50, 100 years? It's this sort of, again, forgive me if I'm using the wrong expressions now, but the sort of areas that we're talking about, which I'm probably generalizing a little bit here and then stretching into kind of environmentalism and things like that. You've got Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which I think was about 1962 or something like that. It's 50 years ago now, and in some ways it feels like we've made a lot of progress, and then in others it really doesn't feel like we have. Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic. I think you have to be. I think the alternative is a self-fulfilling catastrophe. We are agents of change, and if we don't believe we can make any change, then we won't make any change. I mean, it's a sort of tautology, but I mean, so I think you have to believe that you can, with others, make some change. So yes, I am optimistic. The thing I'm most optimistic about, I think, is a shift in emphasis. That's putting it the wrong way. The large-scale landscape resources of wilderness, natural environment, are a precious resource, irreplaceable resource, and their degradation is catastrophic. There's no doubt about that. The decline of big animals in the world because there is just not enough room left for them is a disaster, and it is happening in front of our eyes. There is no doubt about that. The extinction of some of these things is inevitable. It is going to happen. do we have to just cry ourselves to sleep over that? No, we don't. There are things that are just going to happen, and it is a but there are things that we can do nonetheless. And I come back to the urban world. I come back to our lives in urban places. Our day-to-day lives in the places that we inhabit can be transformational in small ways that aggregate to be big ways, if we choose to look at it that way. So when you think about the extraordinary diversity of tiny habitats and food and shelter resources in an average housing estate and its gardens and its lawns and the edges and the clutter and the debris, it's an extraordinary and fascinating realm. It isn't just native plants, it's a mix of native plants and garden plants. Sometimes that goes wildly wrong and we have invasive things launched on the world and we've got to spend billions trying to sort all that out. But if we start to look at the urban world as actually a resource, as a place that we can build up ecological resilience, that is not going to save pandas, it is not going to save snow leopards, but it is going to save familiar but declining local wildlife population, then that is a job that is worth doing. And everyone can play a part and everyone can benefit from that. We just need to have a few simple tools and an enthusiasm to do this stuff.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely agreed. Is there a particular, for someone like me who's relatively new to this area, don't know a huge amount about it, and you know, I've learned a huge amount from you today, so thank you for that. Is there one particular resource that you find yourself recommending quite often? That could be a book or perhaps a documentary or a particular website or anything. Is there the one particular resource that you might suggest those of us who are interested go and have a look at?
Oh my goodness. That, again, there are almost too many, and that's not a very helpful answer, is it?
You can give us more than one, I'll let you.
I think it's a jolly good idea to have a few field guides in your house. So just to have, and not most folks do, to be honest, but to have a flower book and an insect book and a bird book to hand, just so that you can kind of have a go. If you think you've seen something interesting, but you're not sure what it is, find a Facebook site, get someone to help you identify these things. And it's happening more and more, citizen science and the growth in, you know, and the role of Twitter and Facebook groups in particular, just, I mean, they can be just maddening and awful, but they can also be incredibly powerful. And so the growth of nature sites, and sometimes it's cows and chickens and rabbits, and that's fine, but often it is, I saw this moth, I don't know what it is, someone help me, someone tells them, they know what that is, bang, there we are, there's a new piece of information. They're curious about this amazing moth they found because it looks as though it belongs in the tropics. It's always poplar hawk moth. Poplar hawk moth is just, oh, what a godsend that insect is. It's a great big thing. I mean, it looks huge. It's not huge when in comparison to really big stuff, but it, for us, that's a big insect. And it's big and it's cumbersome and it's noisy and it flops about if you get one in your house. But it's absolutely wonderful story behind it. So this is a great big moth. It doesn't feed. So the adult has effectively no mouth parts. Or the reason it's so big is that it has to just live off that fat reserve, that body reserve. Its sole job is to mate and lay eggs. But it's a huge organism and it's an amazing piece of wildlife. It takes us back to its caterpillar. Its caterpillar did all the work. It fed and fed and fed and fed so that it could sustain this glorious insect. Well, what does it eat? How can I get another one of those? What can I do? It's not interested in flowers. It's got no, it's not, it can't feed. What can I do to make sure I get another one? I can look at its food plant. And that thinking starts to kick in. So giving folks resources where they can try and find out what they found. It doesn't have to be down to the name, but what kind of thing is this? What is this extraordinary thing? That gets us over the fear of things that buzz, the fear of things that sting, a more curious approach to the world around us. So field guides are good. Online identification resources, absolutely wonderful. All of those things are great. Beyond that, I'm not sure I have any sort of clear... There are heroes that I've grown up with. One is Richard Feynman, who's obviously a Nobel physicist. My son is a...
Surely you're joking.
Exactly. And those books, you've just said it, those books and his story, that he's a genius. There are no people like that. There are few people like that. Incredibly, that's the whole point. But just that relentless curiosity about the world, not just in his discipline, but in so many other disciplines too, and a willingness to just say something, ask a question, however stupid it might have seemed, and to explore things right down to the nuts and bolts, to get a handle, a real grip on stuff. I mean, an extraordinary man and impossible to emulate, but you can take something from that, and I have, which is that everything is fascinating if you choose to look at it that way, and the stuff in there that will fascinate us and lead to other fascinating things. And what's more, there's a utility to that. There's an application to that. It isn't just the purity of the maths and physics in his case. It is, what can we do with that? Where might that go? The other thing I absolutely love about Richard Feynman is his complete refusal to take responsibility for anything. And I just think that's wonderful, really. That's really hard to do. I mean, and he was, again, in a privileged position as an internationally famous man. He could do that. But I just think a determination not to saddle myself with that stuff that I do not want to be saddled with. And that takes a certain kind of discipline. And that's difficult. But that combination of, I'm not going to be responsible for this stuff, but I am going to be curious about it, is just wonderful.
Yeah, he's an interesting character. Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman is probably his most famous book, and it's well worth a read. Actually, he's an incredible character. A very clearly a brilliant scientist, but also personally a very interesting man as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and not perfect. And just how brilliant that is. You know, I get really fed up with perfect people. and he wasn't. But achieved so much and did so many things and had a complicated life. And I just think it's just brilliant. So he absolutely is a hero. E.O. Wilson, father of island biogeography. So this the science behind the patchiness of the, remember we said at the beginning about wildlife living in some places but not everywhere, and the island biogeography underpins that thinking, and it's still incredibly powerful. Another amazing man, grew up loving ants, and ants led him on to so many other things. And actually, and David Bellamy, who has been exiled because of his views on climate change and to some extent the way that they were reported, but certainly his views on climate change did not fit and do not fit with the way that perhaps the science directs us. But I think as a man who, in my childhood, who just made you want to be like him, and all the caricatures of him too, the whole Lenny Henry thing, just absolutely brilliant. He was always in a hedge. Or crawling about on all, and just for me anyway, I just thought that's it. And he had a beard. I've achieved those two things. I've got a beard and I crawl about in hedges. But so there we are.
Yeah. Life is good.
Yeah,
life is good. So just before we wrap things up, what's next? What's next? What's on the horizon for you guys, both large and small?
I think as a group, we are very, very determined to see the Bay project through. Of course, it will never be through, but we are determined to stick to the idea and the truth that the Bay is an extraordinary place, not just on the island, but in the world, and that there are things that we can deliver here. There are exciting adventures to be had here in the natural world that will stay with you forever, and how we can use that quality to drive regeneration and a positive future for folks who live and visit here. That's something we are very determined to do. And just one other thing to mention, there's so many things I haven't mentioned, but next year, I am absolutely confident the island will be declared a World Biosphere Reserve. So it's just made its application now. So the amazing team at the AOMB, Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty, office at the local authority, Richard and Joel, have been working very, very hard on this for the last year. World Biospheres. World Biospheres, there are 600 odd. There are fewer than World Heritage Sites. It's in the same family, administered through UNESCO. There are only six in the UK. It's a very big deal. And the island has made its application, and we wait to hear. It's a long process, but I am really confident that it will get through. And what an amazing kite mark to have. What an extraordinary expression of optimism about the island as it is and as it can be, that will be. And I look forward to that. And I think all of us working in this field want to capitalize on that and to make that work for the benefit of everybody. I mean, the island is amazing. It's just an amazing place. And that will demonstrate that quality in a way that I think will be profoundly influential. And I look forward to that very much.
Hmm. We've talked, you guys work a lot in the Bay, so we've talked a lot about the Sandown Bay area.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about world biosphere, there must be other areas of the island that are important in that consideration as
well. Oh, absolutely.
Give us a heads up on a few of those.
Well, all of it. it is, on the one hand, you would say, putting my planning head on, it's very heavily designated. What that really means is that the quality of its environment is demonstrated through the highest levels of protection. 75% of the island and its foreshore is protected in policy and law at local, European and international level. Absolutely phenomenal. And that can be difficult if you're trying to build a thing. On the other hand, it is coming back to the very beginning. It's a resource that we haven't really learned to utilize in a way that actually makes development, redevelopment, inward investment, endogenous growth feed off that resource in a way that's self-sustaining. So the whole of the island, I mean, it's I've got my favorite places. Most of them here in the Bay, really, to be honest. But there are lots of wonderful places on the island. There's the whole of the Boldner and Cranmore shoreline, which is just wonderful and wild, and at low tide you might be picking up Ice Age mammal bones off the foreshore. I don't know, there's too many to kind of think of. I've got my sort of favourite spots. I love St George's Down. I love St George's Down in particular because it's got quarry in it, and quarries are absolutely brilliant. We demonise them, and sure enough, they can be hideously polluting and awful, but aggregate quarries, like the one we've got at St George's, Baden Vectis as was, is just amazing. Because the extraordinary, think about a smooth hillside and then think about a quarry in it. Straight away you've massively increased the surface area available for colonisation. Within it there are holes, there are crevices, there are south-facing, north-facing, there's puddles at the bottom, there's dry bits at the top. Quarries are just brilliant. And that working landscape that's been around for 100 and more years of people doing stuff, and at the same time creating, incidentally, as it happens in that case, extraordinary diversity of habitats for wildlife, which we're now beginning to tie together. So what more can we do in our industrial lives that actually stimulate that kind of... I'm just going to give you one little example of why that's so amazing. So there's a little tiny plant called dwarf cudweed. It's a very... it looks like a stick. There's nothing beautiful about it, really. And not so long ago, it was considered extremely rare on the island. And of course, plant populations go up and they go down. It's just the way things work. Nothing's static. Things have good years, things have bad years. But nonetheless, at the time, and for years and years, it was considered to be in one or two locations only on the island. Well, we found some when I was working up on St George's, working with a wonderful, wonderful man, Steve Burton, who runs the quarry, on a project to reinstate a bit of heathland up there using their big machines. Big machinery that's working on sites can be redeployed very quickly and very simply to create habitats. That's one of the things that we can do simply in the built environment. We found a whole load of this stuff growing on a track verge and thought, oh my God, we found the second colony. This is amazing. We got thrilled about it. What should we do? We must garden around it, clip, 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 look after it, put a fence up, whatever. And then we just, metaphorically, because it was a week later, just turned to the right and there were thousands and thousands. And where were they? They were in the areas where all the lorries were turning. And the reason they were there is that they needed that turnover, that change. It was exactly the habitat that they required. Very thin skeletal soils, lots of disturbance, endless seed bank, not much competition, and away they went. So we'd been fretting over a time. In actual fact, it was the remnants, it was the runt bit of this thriving population underneath a load of lorry wheels. And just that stayed with me so much because, again, it wasn't the delicate little bit that was growing under the gorse that mattered. It was the stuff in the lorry park that mattered. And it was fine. It was fine.
Okay. So, yeah, I think there's something for all of us to learn there. So just to finish up with, to say thank you. Really appreciate your time today, Ian. But to finish up with, what do you guys need? For the people that are listening out there, what would you like them to do? Where would you like them to go? Whether that's a website or an event or whatever it might be. And yeah, is there something out there that somebody listening might specifically be able to help you guys with?
It would be good if anyone wants to know what we're doing down here in the Bay. The best place to look is the Facebook site. We use Facebook a lot, which is called Shaping the Bay. And Shaping the Bay goes back to the original Coastal Community Team project 2015, which we have continued to develop with lots of partners involved in that. Lots of very active, determined folks in the Bay trying to make a difference. Really good. So Shaping the Bay will give you a calendar of events and the latest news and if there's stuff coming up. So that's probably your best port of call. We have a website. Just look up ARC Consulting and you can see the kind of range of stuff we do. Similarly, Articology has its own website. Just have a look on Articology Space and you'll see the sort of things we make. And we haven't really talked much about that, but that's the whole marine world. And it's another interview entirely, really. You may be inspired or curious about making things for wildlife, and that perhaps coming back to what can people do. That's one very interesting strand about making stuff for wildlife out of things that are lying around in your home. I know there's the plastics agenda. We've got to be thinking very careful about introducing non-recyclable, endless lifespan objects into the environment. But bits of rubble, bits of old stick, bits of wood from your dismantled bunk bed. What can I do with this stuff? How can I use it? There's a whole world of fascinating experimentation to be done. We may be able to help with some of that. If you've got some ideas, just let us know. Just get in touch if you would like to find ways of getting more involved in nature conservation in ways that you can do simply and directly and enjoyably at home or at school, then just get in touch.
Excellent. That's amazing. Ian, once again, really appreciate your time today. Thank you ever so much. And for those of you listening, obviously we've covered a huge amount of ground here today, but the details of all of those things, all the websites and the books that we've talked about and things, will all be in the show notes. Ian Boyd from ARC, thank you ever so much.
Thank you.
So that was my conversation with Ian Boyd. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you're interested in any of the things that Ian and I discussed, you'll find all the details about the books, links to the websites, how to get in touch with Ian if you want to get involved. All of that you can find at my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston.com, where you will also find my blog and information about the book that I wrote recently, as well as other episodes of the podcast. If you've been enjoying the podcast, it'd be amazing if you could perhaps tell a friend or two about us, about what we're trying to do here. And if you're a really big fan, if you could leave a review on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts, that would make a massive difference to us as well. Either way, thanks very much for listening. We really, really appreciate it. And we look forward to catching up with you again soon. Cheers. Hey, everybody. I'm working on a new podcast project at the moment. This one is about people who have faced and overcome problems. If you know someone, maybe they have recovered from a serious accident or illness, perhaps they beat an addiction of some description, or maybe their life just hit a bit of a rough patch and they found a way to get through it. Whatever it might be, if you or someone you know would be happy to share the story with me, then I'd really love to hear from you.
You can get in touch with me via my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much.